Pleased to be joined in studio by Tyler Moss, a former Flames netminder from the late 90s. How are you?
Pretty good.
It's funny. We've got some common buddies because you finished playing hockey. You're working in the oil patch here in Calgary.
Yeah, at Ensign Drilling. So
very good.
Things have been good.
And we were sitting at the same table at an establishment in town a couple months ago. And I was like, this guy's familiar. How do I know this guy? And all of a sudden, it's, oh, hey, okay, yeah. And then it was KHL stories for like an hour.
Yeah, there's always definitely a lot of KHL stories. It's especially living in Russia, there's tons of stories to talk about.
So it got me thinking, I've got to do some KHL stuff this summer when things are a little slower in the NHL world. Now, today we've got PK fighting with the Habs in arbitration, but July is typically not really riveting news. There's no games to talk about. The Cup's been decided for eons. Free agency slowed down. The draft is done. I'm going to do some KHL stories this summer when Boom's gone and I'm hosting. And so we've done a bunch earlier this week. I wanted to get you on badly, and I'm glad we got you on Friday and we got a bit of time because you spent a considerable amount of time there. First of all, you played your junior in the OHL. You were drafted by the Tampa Bay Lightning in 93 in the second round. Tell us about the transition from pro ranks in North America and the decision to head overseas to go play in what was a very young KHL, and even before that, a Russian Super League.
Yeah, you know what? I was 10 years over here and bounced around the American Hockey League, played a few years in the NHL, and I was turning 30, and I had an agent from actually Riga, Latvia, phone me, and he's like, hey, I got a deal for you in Moscow Spartak, if you're interested. And he sent me a contract, showed me the terms. It was fantastic money. It was a heck of a lot better than going back to the American League. And, you know, I took a few days to decide and ended up signing the contract. Next thing you know, 2 weeks later, I'm on a plane to Moscow, and like July, I think 8th or 9th of, back in 05 or 06, that ended up going over there. And it's nothing like flying into Moscow. And, I heard Jeff Glass's interview yesterday in a city of 15 million people. It's very overwhelming when you first get there.
So had you been overseas before? Have you been to Russia before? And what did you know about at that point? What wasn't even the KHL yet? It was a Russian league that hadn't even grown into the KHL status.
Yeah, at the time it was the Russian Super League. So, made some calls to some guys that had played there. Freddie Brathwaite was a very good friend of mine. We were roommates here in Calgary when we played for the Flames. And we basically grew up pretty close to each other in Ottawa. We went to the same high school and what have you. And he was in Kazan, the previous lockout back in, I think it was 04.
Yep.
When they had that all-star team in Kazan. So I had a lot of questions for him, and he was like, well, you know, if you're not playing in the NHL, it's a pretty good place to play and make some money. So, and then he's like, you're in Moscow. Can't be really be in a better place to play in the Russian League.
So I suppose if you're going to go over to a faraway land, the big city that has all the amenities where you can get good food and you're not, there would be a little bit of English around if you needed it. Moscow was a safer place to go than, say, somewhere in the middle of Siberia.
Definitely. Moscow, it's a lot of people speaking English. Menus are in English also. So I only played 1 year in Moscow, and then I played 5 years or 4 or 5 years in Khabarovsk, which is the far east of Russia, basically Asia. And there's zero English there. So I learned Russian very fast, how to negotiate with taxi drivers, how to read menus. You have to learn Russian because my coaches didn't speak any English. Basically, they would say, you play. The only thing that they could speak in English. But living in Moscow, it was a great, really good city. I met some good people, some Canadian guys that started a restaurant bar in town. And we ended up, that's the one place me and the other Canadian guy, David Ling, used to hang out pretty much every night. It was a guy by the name of Doug Steele from Halifax, Nova Scotia, ended up opening one of the first bars in Moscow back in 1991 or 1992.
Wow.
And
right after the whole breakup of the USSR. Yeah.
And he's got actually a really cool story. Talking to this guy, he's seen everything. And he first went over because his buddies were in a band, and they went over to play, to play a show. And so they're sitting at the airport hotel, and they're like, to their translator, so let's go downtown. And he's like, where do you want to go? well, let's go to a bar. There are no bars.
No bars in Soviet Russia.
Back in 1990, there was no bars in Moscow. So he's like, we got to start a bar.
If there's any way to make money, it's to have the first bar somewhere.
He flies back to Nova Scotia. He basically tells his family, I'm picking up and I'm moving to Moscow and I'm opening a bar. And 2 weeks later, he flew to Moscow and he hasn't been back to Canada since in about probably 20 years.
Wow.
And so he's had several bars and done very well over there.
So I imagine you mentioned David Ling, a guy that also had some time in the NHL. He was on
Columbus,
that team.
Yeah.
So you and him must be awfully tight if you were the only Canadians on that roster.
Well, that's pretty funny. I was almost his agent to get his deal. So he actually signed with Moscow Dynamo. And after, I think it was 3 or 4 weeks of training camp, they didn't pay him yet. So he's like, well, you got to pay me or else I'm going home or because I'm not going on the ice. And they're like, well, I don't think you're going to go home. So we're just going to wait it out. And then he phones me and he's like, hey, Ty, what's going on over at Spartak? And I'm like, well, we need a scorer. And we have a lot of spots open for foreigners. So I ended up talking to our GM and through our translator. Next thing you know, David Ling, he's good player. And I'm like, well, I guarantee he will lead our team in scoring. He might look really bad in practice because he can't skate very fast. And in Russia, skating fast and looking good in practice means more than playing well in games. But he goes, okay, Tyler, I take your word for you. And next thing you know, he's like, offers Linger a contract, and Linger basically left across the street from Dynamo over to Spartak and signed with us, and he was our leading scorer at the end of the year.
He was buying drinks for a while after that, I'm thinking.
Yeah. I ended up getting a couple jobs in Russia.
So we're chatting with Tyler Moss, a former Flames netminder that spent a bunch of time in the KHL. You mentioned you started at Spartak in Moscow. You went off to Khabarovsk, you're calling it. Now, this is a region in Russia that you would not look at a map without borders and suggest it was part of Russia. It is directly north of?
Just to the northeast of North Korea.
So Japan is below Khabarovsk.
Yeah, Japan is very close. It's about an hour flight east of Khabarovsk.
You're closer to Hawaii than you are Moscow.
I'd never looked at it that way, but yes.
So your travel would have been an absolute nightmare. You spent 3 years with the team there?
I think 4 and a bit years.
Okay, so you're really familiar with 4 years it shows here, from 06-07 to 29.
And then I started the next year, and they ended up buying out my contract because I came back from knee operation, ACL surgery, and they didn't want to take the chance, so they ended up buying me out.
So you were there while it was in the Russian League, and then you were there when the franchise moved into the KHL.
Yeah.
That was sort of the transition of 2 years in each over the 4 years there.
Yep.
How horrendous was the travel, and what kind of things could you do when you're 9 time zones away from some other teams and no one's... How close was the nearest team, first off?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. But actually, the nearest team was a six-hour flight.
Six-hour flight.
The closest team.
Closest.
That would be Omsk or Nizhny Komsk, where Bobrovsky played. So people... Fans might know Sergei Bobrovsky. He played in Nizhny Komsk, and that would be our closest team. And Moscow was a 9-hour flight, actually. So we couldn't even charter to Moscow because it was so far, so we ended up taking commercial flights on Aeroflot, and that was on the equivalent of like a 747, but it was called an Aluhin 96, which is a very massive, the biggest plane in Russia. And, you know, it was a 9-hour flight. So we would leave... We would basically leave the day before a game at 10 in the morning. So we'd meet at the airport at the rink at, say, 8:30, and, you know, get to the rink or airport at 9 o'clock. 10 o'clock, we'd fly out, 7-hour flight, 9-hour flight, 7-hour time change. And then as soon as we'd land in Moscow, I'd say noon hour or so, basically fight that traffic that Jeff Glass was talking about yesterday.
Moscow traffic, legendary.
Moscow traffic is absolutely ridiculous. We would fight traffic to go to practice. And have our basically the night before practice of the game.
So you would gain 9 hours. You would travel for probably 12 to 13 with the traffic in Moscow and get right on the ice for practice.
Yep. Not even go to the hotel, like right from airport to the hotel, or sorry, from the airport right to the rink.
And that practice. And that would be what, the night before the game or day of the game by the time you got there? Or was it day before? I'm trying to, all this time change messed with my head.
Yeah, I know. But you basically land at, say, noon hour or so, and then you'd have a 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon practice in Moscow. So we'd go fight traffic, get to the practice, and throw our gear on right away. Practice for an hour and a half or so. You know, get undressed, shower, and then traffic to the hotel. And by the time you get to the hotel, you have the in Russia, it's mandatory team meals, so you always have to eat with your team. Especially when you're on the road, whether it's lunch or breakfast or dinner, you always have to be with your team, even though the food is absolutely awful that they serve us. And we're professional athletes making very good money over there, but they serve you absolute terrible food.
Jeez. So that's just to get to Moscow. Now, how long were the road trips? Would you try to cut down on travel by staying over there for a few weeks at a time or not?
No. It's pretty much the same for everybody. Usually it's two games at home, two games on the road, or you know, three or four games at home, and then you go on the road for three or four games. So we would definitely travel quite a bit. We'd maybe fly to Moscow, play one game, and then fly out to Siberia, which would, you know, or anywhere outside of Moscow would be a 2-3 hour flight, and you're pretty much at most of the teams. But you know, it's a ton of travel. The country's massive. You know, if you look at a map and you look where all the teams are, they're pretty much all over the place. You know, you got three or four in Moscow, which is great. You got St. Petersburg, but then everything else is about a 2-hour, 3-hour flight outside Moscow, besides the two or three Siberian teams, which would be about a 4-hour flight. And then Khabarovsk, where I played, it was 9 hours.
9 hours. And you said six hour trip for the closest team in the league. Yeah. We're chatting with Tyler Moss, former Flames netminder, who spent considerable time in the KHL and in Russia even before it was the KHL. What changed when it went from the Russian Super League to the KHL? Or was it business as usual at Khabarovsk, or however you pronounce the place you were playing?
You know what? To be honest, I don't think a whole lot changed other than a lot of money behind the marketing side with the government getting behind it. And the biggest thing is Gazprom. You have Alexei Medvedev, who's the head of the export side of Gazprom.
And this is a big oil and gas company over there, correct?
Obviously, yeah. One of the biggest, probably besides Saudi Aramco, I think the second biggest in the world for oil and gas. And, you know, Medvedev is the guy who's been trying to buy an NHL team for a while, and he, I think Bettman's turned him down a few times, and he decided to buy take over St. Petersburg. So
SK, right?
SKA, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So basically it's the former Army team, so SKA. And he wants this league now, with all his marketing behind it and all the marketing money, to try and compete with the NHL. So, and the Russian guys, they'd rather play in Russia, though. Yeah, that's their hometown. That, you know, their wives, their kids, they're Russian. They don't speak any English, and it's easier for them to play in that country, make really good money, rather than coming over here and trying to tough it out for 82 games. And, you know, you never know what's going to happen for them, and, you know, long road trips, and then their wives are at home, their kids are at home, and they don't speak any English. And
so, what percentage of the best NHL caliber Russians are showing up in the NHL? Because we still have a lot of elite players over here. You've got your Malkins, Ovechkins, Bobrovsky. There's a lot of fantastic Russians in the league, but you're not seeing them drafted as much, and you're certainly seeing more and more stars like Radulov and Kovalchuk preferring to play in an inferior league in Russia because, A, it's their home country, and, yeah, it's more comfortable. So what percentage of these guys is the NHL getting that theoretically they would have got, let's say, 10, 15 years ago?
I think it's tough to put a number on percentage-wise. But you're the NHL, the guys that are coming over, they're the best players in the world, right? You got Ovechkin, Malkin, like you said, and Bobrovsky. And you got a handful of extremely good Russian players. But on the other hand, you know, you got some guys in Russia that you've never heard, no fan has ever heard of that's listening right now, that's making $3-4 million in Russia tax-free.
And which is the equivalent of making 6, 7, 8 over here, depending where you are, right?
So if I'm a Russian guy, do I want to live at home and make $4-5 million, $3-5 million and not pay tax and live at home? I think it's a no-brainer for some of these guys. 54 games. It's what they're comfortable with. It's what they grew up with. And it's not a grind, the schedule. You always have, you know, a day off between games. The only problem is it seems like they always have their thumb on you, the coach and staff. You're always under the microscope. Like we have curfew. We have most teams have, I think every team has a rule you're not allowed to consume alcohol.
Period.
Like, if they catch you having a beer, they could actually terminate your contract. So it's pretty typical just to go, you know, have one or two beers after a game and enjoy a win and talk about it. But if you're not playing very well, you better make sure that nobody sees you drinking that beer.
Crazy. Now, another thing that's interesting here, you get... You mentioned how important it was to look in practice, and yet the compensation system is set up where after every win, players are getting how much in bonuses for wins per game?
Yeah, we were talking about that the other night when we went for dinner. So it really varies from team to team, but some teams will pay, in Europe, it's 3 points for a win in regulation, or 2 points for a win in overtime.
And then one for the tie.
And one for a tie loss, an overtime loss or a shootout loss. So some teams will pay anywhere from $500 a point to $1,000 a point. And, you know, $1,000 a point, so if you win the game in regulation, there's $3,000 per guy.
So team points. So each player is going to get $3,000 for a win.
Yeah. Out of the 20 guys dressed that night, they don't all get it. That's another story. But so... For instance, let's say we win the game and it was a $3,000 point night. Then the coaches would decide, they would evaluate you on a 0 to 3 scale of how you played in the winning game.
And that would be how much cash you got.
And then obviously, if you got a 2 out of 3, you didn't contribute as much, so you only get 2,000 out of the 3,000. But basically, you know, the older guys would get the full bonus and the young guys were lucky to get 1 or 2, no matter what.
It seems like seniority and being Russian is the best thing you can do to make money in the K, aside from being a good hockey player. It sounds like a place where tenure is very well respected, and that if you're going to make money, you better have been a good soldier for this league or for a certain owner for a while. Is that fair to say?
I don't know if it's if you can say like you got to be in the league for a long time, but. I don't see any loyalty from teams to players, because if you, like, I know a lot, I've been there, I was there for 5 years, and guys would bounce around from team to team to team to team, and they'd go from 8 points to 10 points to 8 points to 12 points, and these guys are making a lot of money. It's like, what's going on here, guys? Like, this guy can't even play in the American Hockey League, and meanwhile, he's making $1 million, $1.5 million. But the famous saying in Russia, he's such a good practice player.
They love the practice player.
He looks good in practice. He just has to bring it together one day.
Which is the exact opposite of the NHL. Is that fair to say?
Pretty much. They don't. Obviously, everybody in the NHL, everybody works hard in practice. You know, the best players bring it out in the game. And in Russia, it's like, I always laugh about this. We would do the shooting drill. The first drill of practice, we do a shooting drill. Just to warm the goalies up and that was usually a one-timer from the slot or something. The goalie's favorite, obviously. And then we would do three-on-ones.
Three-on-ones.
Three-on-ones. And when the guys would tic-tac-toe, you know, like, you know, 3-4 backdoor passes.
Right, like you should on a three-on-one.
Yeah, definitely. You know, obvious back-checkers, you know, they never back-check, right, in practice. So guys are going tic-tac-toe back and forth. And then they would score into the empty net, and I'd be all, you know, maybe get a little... mad.
Get heated, yeah. Yeah, like, this is the way to start this practice. Get a guy lit up.
Exactly, yeah. And then the coach would start clapping and applauding and be like, oh, that's awesome, guys. Like, good job. And I'm just sitting there going, there's not a chance this is ever going to happen in any game. It doesn't matter if we're on a 5-on-3. This will not happen. But the coaches, you know, they're all excited about a pretty play in practice.
How much more valuable is a Russian passport than, say, a Canadian one for the exact same player? If you were, let's say, split time between two countries, let's say your dad played in the NHL, you've got both passports, how much more valuable would the Russian guy be versus the Canadian guy be?
I'd have to say it's extremely valuable to have a Russian passport. It'd be minimum 50% more on your salary. Easily.
Half to double, would that be fair, in terms of that much more?
Yeah.
$1 million Canadian might be $1.5 million as a Russian, or $2 million guys a Russian.
Yeah, definitely. And your lifespan is forever. Whenever you decide to be done in the league, I think you could play forever if you had a Russian pass. I was actually very close to getting a Russian passport. So my first year in the league, I was with Moscow Spartak. The second league, I moved over to Khabarovsk, and Vladislav Tretiak came up with the idea that there was too many foreign goalies coming into the Russian league, so he decided to impose a luxury tax on the goalies. In the first year, it was $175,000 that the team had to pay.
We're talking about a tax on import goalies.
Yeah.
You're a Canadian, you go over there, and suddenly the powers that be say, we think there's too many import netminders. All the teams that have guys not from Russia, you got to pay more.
Yeah, I think it was $175,000 the first year. And then, so my third year in the league, which would be, I believe, the last year of the Russian Super League, the tax ended up being $350,000 tax to sign an import goalie.
This probably cost you a fair amount of money, because suddenly you are less attractive than the same player with a Russian passport.
Pretty much I'm plus $350,000 of what his contract would be.
Right. So so how did they do that? Did they just take $300,000 out of what they were already going to pay you?
Well, to be honest, it was it didn't really factor into the negotiation. They just looked at it, well, we got to pay it, and we want you, and we want to sign you long term. So the interesting thing about Khabarovsk is, and the reason why I played in the Far East for so long was I ended up kind of becoming a little bit friendly with the president of our team, who's it's kind of formerly basically mafia guy from
KGB.
Not KGB. They're full
different
on,
mafia.
Different mafia.
My goodness.
From Nizhny, Novokuznetsk, which is a city in Siberia, and these guys made their money there. The president of the team was the right-hand man of a guy named Shishkin, who ended up buying the steel factory.
Okay.
And essentially what happened a few years back was the governor, who would be the equivalent of a premier here for the province. So the governor, who has a lot of control of where the money goes in the city and in the province, rather, basically put the metal factory up for sale, and the hockey team came with it because they were the title sponsor, and whoever wanted to buy it had to float the budget for the hockey team.
You're buying the steel, but the company, but you also have to keep this hockey team alive, because that comes as a package deal with the steel factory or whatever it was.
And you guys touched on it a little bit yesterday. That's the way hockey is done in Russia. Companies support the hockey teams. So basically, this guy Shishkin made a lot of money. He bought the factory, supported the team, foot the bill for the whole budget for all our charters and salaries for the whole team, for staff. And now lives in Moscow. He's in Putin's government. He's in the
former mafia guy.
Yeah, well, that's what happens.
Wouldn't be the only one, huh?
He has his own jet. He has his own plane. He does pretty well.
So you became close with the president, and that probably extends your longevity in the league, or at least gets you over the hurdle of what was then an import tax on goalies.
Yeah, and the other reason why I felt comfortable, my first year in Moscow playing for Spartak, I didn't get my last four paychecks, actually.
Four
months of pay. And then I signed in Khabarovsk the next year, and three guys on my team, Russian guys, that played with me in Spartak, and I'm like, hey guys, you guys get your money? And they're like, no. I'm like, yeah, me neither. But then at Christmas time, we're playing Spartak, and a guy comes and gives me my money. And next thing you know, I ask the other Russian guys, I'm like, hey, you guys get paid? And they're like, no. And I'm like, yeah, me neither.
I'm not sharing with you. No, do they cut you a check, or is it a suitcase of money? Because we've heard both from this league. We've heard direct deposit. We've heard cash in paper bags. Everything short of gold coins from Scrooge McDuck pool is what we've heard of how they get paid in Russia.
I can't remember what my first year was. I think it was 05, 06. So my first year was in Spartak, and they paid us in cash.
Hard cash.
I signed basically some documents for the government, the Russian government, saying I made basically $1,000 a month. So they paid 13% tax in Russia. So I didn't pay very much taxes.
A little hocus pocus there.
Yeah. And then and it's kind of interesting the way they would pay guys over there. So after we usually practice at night over there. So you had a 5 o'clock practice, 5 to 7, let's say. By the time you shower and get ready and get dressed, you go over to where all the offices are at about 8:30, and guys would line up outside the accountant's office, and you'd one by one go into the office, and she'd pull out some cash and put it in the throw it in the cash machine and
the counter.
The counter, yeah. It was pretty famous. 10 grand.
10 grand. There you go.
But you know, some of the guys, the young guys, they'd walk out with maybe 1,000, 2,000, 3,000. I think there's a minimum now of maybe 200,000 for guys to make first per season. But
right.
But back then, you could pay the young guys anything. And it's kind of interesting that Dave Ling and I, we would never accept our money at night.
Because, of course, it's night in Moscow. There's a lot of people that would do a lot of things for that kind of money that you're carrying on you in cash.
Yeah. And, you know, we'd walk home. And David actually lived right across the street from the rink. I lived about 6 blocks away, so we'd always walk. But we'd never accept our money, and we'd be like, well, we're not signing. That's, you know, it's your responsibility till tomorrow. We'll come, and then you'd have a practice in the morning also. And after the morning practice, we'd get the team driver to drive us right to the bank so we could deposit the money. Well, I think it was the second time David was getting paid. I think so, we didn't accept money.
Because it's nighttime.
Nighttime, yep. So we go to a movie. They had an English movie theater in Moscow. We come back from the movies, and David, we basically go up to his apartment, and there's 6-8 police officers with AK-47s outside his door, inside his apartment. He's like, what's going on here? And basically, they're like, through broken English, and they had one inspector, I guess, would be a higher-up cop, came over and was kind of trying to relay the message in English that your apartment got broken into, and we're here to do an investigation.
And right after he was supposed to get paid.
It was payday.
It was payday. They knew it was payday. Now, was it somebody, were the cops in on it, or was it someone before the cops?
I don't want to point fingers, but the keys in Russia, it's not like you're going to break into a normal apartment building. These things are steel doors, and it's like those old school keys that back in like the 1800s or so, you know, they're like 5 inches long with just the end on them.
The skinny in the middle and then the thing at the end.
Yeah. So like I don't think you can pick those too easily. So they basically went in and stole all his girlfriend's clothes and took a bunch of his clothes. And, you know, he had some money laying around, but nothing of significance of what, a month's pay would have been. And it's just very ironic that it was the day that we got paid.
I don't know if it is ironic. That sounds not a coincidence after all, was it?
Well, he seemed to think it was an inside job because he's like, there's not a chance somebody could break into my apartment. The cops were trying to tell him someone, you know, basically climbed up the wall and went into his apartment window on the fourth floor. But there's absolutely no chance unless the guy was, you know, in Cirque du Soleil or something.
The human fly.
Yeah.
Any other incidents like that where I'm pretty sure a conspiracy theorist mind would run wild in Russia, because the government is filled with guys that used to be in the KGB, and the government is essentially running this league or fronting the cash along with these big multinational companies to run the league, right?
Here's kind of a funny story of why import goalies were very popular back 7-8 years when I first, even just before I went over, was basically... the Russian guys were telling me that they only wanted to sign us because they thought all the Russian goalies were on the take.
On the take?
Yeah.
The fix was in with the Russian goalies.
Yeah, they thought they were taking money on the side through the gambling.
Jeez.
So.
Did you have any money issues after Spartak? Because as you said, from that point forward, you were pretty close with the owner that you had in Khabarovsk, and you ended up elsewhere after that. But were money issues a continual thing, or more of the one-off in your first stop in the league?
Yeah, it was just in Spartak. And I think yesterday Jeff Glass was touching on that. He played in Spartak last year, and they basically, the sponsor decided he wasn't going to pay anymore last year. And that's pretty much what happened to us years ago. Essentially, what most teams are doing is you're going to, whether it's banks or large companies, and the biggest thing is basically government going to a lot of companies and saying, hey, here's the local team, and we'd like X amount of money. And if the company's like, well, we're not really hockey fans, we're not going to support that. And it's like, hey, okay, no problem. Well, we're just going to have our tax department come and look
come
at
audit
your,
you.
Come audit you. We're going to shut you down until we decide that you are, you know, paying proper taxes. And then a lot of the Russian companies decide, well, you know what? How much was that check that you wanted for the
really
hockey?
Really into hockey all of a sudden. Yeah. My boy's been talking about, I want to get behind hockey in Russia.
And you know what? That's the way things work. Everybody says, how's that league in Russia? And I basically said, there's three tiers. You got your top eight teams. There's roughly, 24 teams or so in the league now?
Sure.
Your top eight teams are all your oil companies, and they every year they're the same teams. They pump a lot of money in. You got your Kazan, Omsk, Lokomotiv. You get your big companies that really rally behind these cities. And outside of Moscow and St. Petersburg, there's not a lot to do in Russia.
Sure.
It's pretty desolate.
People aren't rolling around with cash in their pockets with nothing to do. It's a little more difficult for the ordinary Russian, right?
Well, I think tickets are $10 to $15, $10, $15, 6, 7, 8,000 fans. You're a lot of charter after every game. Guys are making, a couple million bucks, some of these high-paid Russian guys. You're not making money on revenue.
Yeah, no, that's true. You're making money because, as you said,
it's sponsorship.
Government certainly encouraged that. Putin's a huge hockey fan. He's one of the reasons this thing is what it is, right?
Yeah, that's what I was going to get at. It's he is a hockey fan, but his biggest thing is there's not a lot going on, like I was saying, in Russia, but they like to bring morale as a country, like through sport. So if the local team is doing well, it's almost like a morality thing that the people feel good about themselves in the town, and it's the only thing really going in the town. It's that hockey or soccer, and if you got a successful team, people it's everywhere. It's in the media. They're talking about it all the time. Otherwise, there's nothing to talk about because there's nothing going on in the town.
A source of civic pride, to be sure. And we talked to Dave King about, 3 weeks, a month ago. Mm-hmm. And he was the first guy to go coach that the team with after the plane accident. He got brought in at the end of the season. And he said he would walk around town. People would literally come up crying to him, shaking his hand, thanking him for what he'd done for the city. And that was just because they got in a hot run and made the playoffs. So you're right. Absolutely. Cities identify with the success of their team, I guess.
Yeah, and Yaroslavl it's kind of like the New York Rangers of the NHL where the plane went down. It's very unfortunate. I had Pavel Dimitro is a roommate of mine. We lived together my second year pro. Joseph Vasichek, he sat beside me in the room and playing for the Hurricanes. So it was, really touched me quite heavily. So, and that team is like the New York Rangers or the Montreal Canadiens of the Russian League. They're the ones that are always the perennial team. They're always in the top three or four. Every guy wants to play on that team. Their big sponsor is the railroad company.
Hmm. Of course, Lokomotiv, right?
Yeah. So, unbelievable arena, 10,000 people. The fans come. It's about a three-hour drive outside Moscow, and it's a hockey hotbed. It's a lot of kids come from. And it's very different from the way the kids grow up in Russia. They basically grow up in a school. So you grow up in the Yaroslavl hockey school as a little kid. You can grow all the way up. And, their ideal, they want you to play for their team, right? And they don't want you to go to the NHL. They'd rather you just grow up and play for Lokomotiv for 10 years. Or if you're from Omsk, they put all that money into you. And they want you to play on the big team. And that's why, obviously, a few years ago, there was a lot of talk about the NHL and the KHL and having that agreement between each other and what the compensation was if guys went over to the NHL.
Yeah, because these organizations have had them since they were teenagers funding minor hockey and then through their junior programs, and then, boom, they're off to the NHL, and the Russian teams are saying, we've brought this kid up and given him gear since he was eight. Why don't we get any compensation for this?
Yeah, and I understand where they're coming from because a lot of these people, their parents don't have any money. Like these guys they're paying, the school pays for everything. They're paying for their food. They're paying for their training. They're paying for them to go to school, I imagine. They're paying sometimes for their accommodations because they might be from outside of the city, or they're bringing them into their hockey school, as they call it. And then, you're 5, 6, 7 years old and you grow up until you're 19, 20, and then you all of a sudden you decide to go to the NHL. So.
Poof, gone. Tyler, fantastic insights. Appreciate it. And I'm sure the fan feedback line will be buzzing here at 960-960. Thanks for your time today.